It's estimated that as many as 4 million people have died over 5 years of civil war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They died as a direct result of fighting, but also from hunger and disease and dislocation. This fighting has involved soldiers from 7 countries, that is in addition to the Congo, and many rebel groups. The result has been one of the worst humanitarian emergencies of recent decades. Now, this fighting officially, formally ended years ago, but the violence and disruption has continued, and there has in fact been a serious outbreak of fighting in the eastern part of the country. It began late last summer and has continued over the last few months. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be trying to get a better understanding of this long-running conflict as we talk with Howard Wolpe. He's director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He also is a former 7-term member of Congress, former presidential special envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region. He's a specialist in African politics, and for 10 of his 14 years in Congress, Dr. Wolpe chaired the Subcommittee on Africa of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where he was very instrumental in effecting changes in U.S. policy on Africa, including the ending of military assistance to General Mobutu in Zaire. That's what it was called before it became the Democratic Republic of Congo. He also was involved in the passage of the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Dr. Wolpe, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, this is one of those cases where I'm afraid that in order to try to get a better understanding of what is happening now, one has to go back and talk about what has happened here in Congo at various points over about the last 14 years. Not to spend too much time on background, but I think perhaps first, I ought to ask you to remind us about something that happened actually not in Congo, but in one of the neighboring countries, Rwanda. All the way back now, we're going to 1994. Just very quickly remind us of the Rwandan genocide of 94.
Yeah, I think the easiest way of understanding what's happening now is actually to think of two sets of issues or problems that have converged together to create the chaos. The first is not just 14 years, but 40 years of Mobutu, who left a country that was totally destroyed, a genuinely failed state, totally fragmented, no sense of state cohesion, and it was just represented a political vacuum throughout most of the country. The administrative power of the state did not really extend very effectively to all parts of the country. Then you have the event of which you speak, which is the Rwandan genocide of 1994. And a good part of the violence that we are seeing now is basically the residue of that genocide, because what happened is that when the RPA government, the Tutsi-led government, came back to power and put an end to the genocide, many hundreds of thousands, over a million Rwandan Hutus escaped from Rwanda, went into the Congo. One of the biggest failings of the international community was to allow these refugees to be sited at refugee camps right on the border. These refugee camps came to be basically taken captive or hostage by those who had led the genocide. And so you had two separate wars in the Congo. The first invasion by Rwanda and Uganda was an effort to dismantle these refugee camps that had come to be used as bases to continue launching attacks against Rwanda, with the genocidaires still having the fantasy of ultimately finishing the job that they had started in Rwanda. Today in Congo, you still have remnants of those genocidaire-led forces, maybe 15,000, 10 to 15,000 is the best estimate we have. They have taken residence in the Congo. They have integrated themselves in some measure within some communities, scattered throughout the eastern side of the Congo, the north and south Kivu provinces. They have become a tremendously destructive force. And it is the Congolese people themselves who have been the principal victims of what is a continuing Rwandan conflict on Congolese soil. And so the most recent military activity that we've seen has led to a Tutsi-led militia, that is a Congolese Tutsi-led militia, confronting the Congolese army, which has been providing support and assistance to some of these remnants of the genocidaires, of the genocidal forces, known as the FDLR in eastern Congo. That's what the battle and the struggle has been all about.
Hmm. Just going back to what happened when Mobutu was removed from power. Just to remind people, this was a Belgian colony until 1960. In 1960, when it became independent, 1965, that's when Mobutu took over, renamed the country Zaire. He was in power until 1997, when rebels led by a man named Laurent Kabila toppled him. And this was at a point where not only was Mobutu's grip on power crumbling, but he also himself was dying. He was in very poor health. So Kabila managed to take over with the support of a number of neighboring countries.
Mainly Uganda and Rwanda.
Uganda and Rwanda. And Mr. Kabila became president, and this didn't last very long. He began losing support very fairly quickly. The economy was not doing well. There was, even at this time, this resentment among Congolese Tutsis that felt that either they were not getting the support of the government or they were actually being persecuted by the government. And eventually what happened was, and it didn't take very long, this was in 2001, Kabila was assassinated and his son took over. Would it have been possible, do you think, for Laurent Kabila to actually have consolidated his support and for that to have been something eventually of a peaceful transition, or could that not have happened?
No, I think that, in fact, to the contrary, Kabila turned out to be a very, very difficult and ineffective national leader who was so paranoid that rather than reaching out to try to broaden the space of support, and initially his coming into Kinshasa was people rejoiced because it really did represent the end of Mobutuism. And the initial rhetoric sounded like there was a new, very hopeful moment for the Congo. But instead of recognizing his opportunities and his possibilities, he became increasingly developed a siege mentality, very paranoid, and very, very authoritarian. So political space kept diminishing throughout the Congo. And he just increasingly found himself with a narrower and narrower political base.
One of the things that has made this conflict, I'm sure, more difficult is that a number of the neighboring countries that surround the Democratic Republic of Congo have involved themselves in the conflict, perhaps in some cases because they felt that they had security reasons, and in some cases just because they felt that there was an opportunity for them to profit, I mean, literally to plunder resources of Congo. Can you talk a little bit about what the motivation of the surrounding countries has been, either to try to support the government or to weigh in on the side of rebels who were fighting against the government?
Well, yes. First, it should be said that if clearly a number of parties have benefited from the chaos in the war. A lot of military generals on all sides of the conflict ended up becoming essentially economic warlords from neighboring countries that were involved in the conflict in the Congo. But I think it would be a mistake to argue that it was the economics that drove the conflict in the first instance. What drove the conflict were primarily security concerns on the part of Rwanda that saw these genocidaires that still had taken root in the Congo and saw a government that was either unable or unwilling to confront these remaining rebel forces. On the part of Uganda, where some rebels who were opposing the Ugandan government were also operating from Congolese soil. Case of Angola, you had UNITA that had gained a lot of support and assistance from Mobutu and were also operating inside the Congo. So it was this broader set of concerns that into this administrative vacuum that had become the Zaire, all of these forces that were hostile to countries in the surrounding region had taken root, had become established. And I think those were initially that was the driving, the most compelling dimension of what happened. Then once the war got underway and Zimbabwe became involved and Uganda and Rwanda more deeply involved, then you began to have this pattern of these interveners also wanting to extract some economic benefit from their intervention. So then you had a broadening of the motivations really behind the conflict.
Mm-hmm. It seems that after now this period of fighting, roughly speaking, I guess we're talking about maybe about 5 years, going back to, I think, maybe about 2003, things started to look at least a little bit better. A lot of the foreign troops had left the country. By 2003, I believe, both of the main rebel groups had signed peace agreements with the government. So had Rwanda and Uganda. Elections had been set for 2005. They ended up being postponed, but they did actually happen at the end of 2006. No single candidate got enough of the vote to win, but Joseph Kabila, the son of Laurent Kabila, came out on top, and then eventually there was a runoff, and he was elected outright. So it looked like actually by at least, I don't know, maybe the end of 2006, that there was the hope for a more stable, long-term kind of peace in the country.
I think that was only appeared that way superficially from the outside.
Mm.
Those of us who were involved in the diplomacy and who were on the ground and engaged with the Congolese during this period recognized that the surface appearance did not correspond with the underlying reality. The fundamental problem in the Congo is that as a result of these 4 years of Mobutuism, there is no sense of a national, coherent political vision, no degree of cohesion. Leaders don't trust each other. You had a political culture develop in the Congo, established by Mobutu's example, really, of a very self-serving leadership and of politics being a zero-sum game in which one person's success could only come at the expense of the other. There was no recognition of interdependence, unlike some other political transitions, such as in South Africa, where Mandela and de Klerk were able to achieve an incipient partnership that drove the transition. There was none of that in the Congo. People ended up signing agreements, whether in Lusaka or later on in Sun City, as a product of a tremendous amount of external pressures and the like. But there was never any real sense of partnership or trust amongst the key players. That is why, I should add, that we at the Wilson Center now are very deeply involved in the Congo, because what happened as the election was approaching, the diplomatic community, that up to that moment in time had been so focused upon the logistics of mounting the new election, which were horrendously difficult, suddenly realized that there had been no political preparation for the election. And so we had been working in the Wilson Center and partnership with others in a leadership training initiative that was a new model, an experiment in neighboring Burundi, where we decided that it was necessary, if Burundi was to have any chance of survival following years of intercommunal massacres, genocide, and conflict, that it was necessary to build a training program for key leaders to help rebuild some sense of their interdependence, a recognition that they could be stronger through collaboration, and to help to rebuild some trust and rebuild the relationships among key leaders to drive the transition. That was tremendously successful in Burundi, and we were asked to begin to mount the same kind of program in the Congo, that effort we are still engaged in. But the Congo, of course, is a 60 million population, whereas neighboring Burundi was under 7 million. Mm. So the challenges, of course, are immense, and it's going to take some time to achieve the kind of critical mass that has really made a profound difference to the Burundian transition.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Howard Wolpe. He's director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and is an expert in Africa and American foreign policy. He's a former seven-term member of Congress, also former presidential special envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region. When he was in the Congress for most of his time there, he chaired the Subcommittee on Africa of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and was very involved in U.S. policy and making U.S. policy in Africa. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller to bring into the conversation here in Champaign County, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering how you mean that economics wasn't fundamental. It may not have been incidentally fundamental in the intervention, but it was clearly the exploitation that made a lot of people accept the status quo. And I'm not just pointing at the what we might call the new frontline states. Clearly, the U.S. is benefiting from the chaos. The U.S. role has sort of been unspoken here. Mobutu didn't just appear. He was installed. He was used to aid UNITA by the CIA. The CIA killed Lumumba. They tipped off the South Africans to where they could capture Mandela. The U.S. role is going a little bit too unspoken here, and that's what's motivating me to call. I don't blame the U.S. for everything, but the U.S. is certainly doing a lot of damage here.
Yeah.
Cheney voted against the bill that I guess you championed in '86. The machinations that are going on now are on a grand scale, and I'd like for you to address some of that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the caller makes a very good point about history, but I don't think that analysis applies to the last several years. There's no question that the United States was complicit, in my view, in the assassination of Lumumba. The Belgians did the deed, but the United States certainly did not resist that action. There's no question that economics drove a good part of American calculations back in the 60s, or before the 60s and into the 60s. And that is part of the reason why, and that we helped put Mobutu into power. All of that is a matter of historical record, which is why I always believed when I was chairing the Africa Subcommittee that American national interests are not well served by the identification with a dictator that had lost support of the population and that had become this kleptomaniac and was simply pillaging the Congo for his own personal advantages. However, having said that, to take that history and to kind of project it into the more recent situation is simply not accurate. The United States, beginning in the Clinton years and subsequently, was not advantaged in the least by the conflict or by the war. And the United States, and I think this is true of both Clinton and Bush administration Africa programs or Africa bureaus, understood that the best American interests would be far better served by stabilizing the region and bringing an end to the conflict. And so the diplomatic resources of the United States have been fully engaged under both administrations. It's one of those few areas where there was actually more continuity of policy than a change of policy when Bush came in trying to help ameliorate the conflict, get the parties disarmed, get the foreign actors to withdraw, and to try to help stabilize the situation in the Congo. But, unfortunately, the legacy of those years that in which America and the Western world was not a very constructive partner with Zaire, that legacy is still largely responsible for the kind of chaos that we are now witnessing in the Congo. So we're living with that history, but the policies have changed quite dramatically in recent years.
Well, I would take issue with the idea that diplomacy under Clinton or under this administration is fully engaged. I think there could be a lot more efforts made. A lot of different things could be done. In fact, I think you'll probably agree with that, and you probably have some prescriptions. But the idea that, you know, copper during the Katanga crisis was, you know, fundamental, and that's, you know, in the record, as you say. Coltan and the other resources that are being got out of that whole area at fire sale prices because of the chaos, I don't think it can be dismissed as easily as that. And
Well, I was, you know, at least in the Clinton years, I was, you know, helping to make the policy. And I know what we saw as American interest, and I know what we did as a matter of policy. And there was not one instance in which our calculations were driven by some notion that America was going to come out ahead by a continuation of the conflict. Yes, I think there are some things we could have done, should have been doing. I was very disappointed when the new administration came in that we did not appoint another special envoy to continue the work that we had been doing under the Clinton years. I think that would have given more vitality and dynamism to American diplomacy in the region. I think that the whole question of the resources available, both for peacekeeping, we haven't provided sufficient resources. It was frankly embarrassing that even as the election was preparing, the United States was hardly offering any funding toward that. Most of the burden of that was borne by the European Union. So I think there are some things that we could be doing more of and do a better job of, but the basic thrust of policy has really been as I've described it.
Yeah. I got another caller I want to get to. Just again, though, to stay with the question of the amount of resources that the international community is putting into Congo, I think it is true that they have been considerable, maybe not enough, but considerable, and has involved the U.S. and the EU and the United Nations. In fact, I believe that the contingent of U.N. troops that are in Congo are the biggest anywhere in the world right at the moment. Has that all, would you say, though, having said all that, that still somehow that the kind of attention that the international community has given to Congo has not been sufficient?
Yeah, and that's not just a criticism of the United States. I mean, the problem here is that Congo is so huge and the problems are so immense. And so the challenges require substantial financial commitments. You're right. I mean, I don't want to underestimate what the United States and others have done. In fact, the United States government right now is very supportive of the kind of cost of transformation work that we're undertaking there and has been supportive from the beginning of this peace process. I'm just making the argument that the enormity of the task is such that it's unfortunate that other issues, such as Iraq, Afghanistan, and the like, have really at least limited in some measure what would have in other circumstances become available, I think.
Mm. Well, I appreciate the comments at the last call. Let's go on to the next, Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning, Howard. This is A.M. Babukamba. I participated in a number of appeals to you through Sterek with Nzongola and the late Paul Emongu.
Oh, sure. Well,
yeah.
Good morning.
Welcome. Good morning. It's a pleasure to hear you. I want to follow up in a line of questions that the previous caller raised, and that is the issue of the interest in the natural resources of the Congo, which, again, you spoke in passing of, but not getting to the fundamental, I think, issue as to how the war, even initially as you characterized it, by Rwanda to invade the Congo in order to dismantle the genocidal, you know, camps in Goma, et cetera, you know, was. And that is, yes, at the beginning it was true, but when you look at after that initial incursion, how far the Rwandans went all the way to Bakongo, which had no genocidal to speak of, and to cross to such an extent that this is, I'm talking about 1998, for example, go into the city of Kinshasa, etc., to try to attempt to, you know, dismantle genocidal is simply not a part of what is known to be the reality. And as you were aware, Wayne Madison, in his book Genocide and Covert Operation in Africa, 1993-1999, and independently, Colette Brackman, the Nouveau Predateur, the New Predators, speak of the basic thrust or motivation, rather, that led to the initial invasion of the Congo to remove Mobutu and subsequently to place Laurent Kabila, who had no experience in leading a country. As you know, he had been in the Maquis for a long time, but was inconsequential to Mobutu, while the West, including particularly the U.S. and France and Belgium, supported Mobutu blindly in what he was doing. So that history is not negligible, nor is the issue.
Yeah. No, I think what I said is pretty consistent with what you just said. One is that the historical responsibilities are very clear and quite dramatic, and we're still, as I said, experiencing the legacy of that earlier period of exploitation and manipulation by Western powers.
That's right.
Secondly, I think I indicated that subsequent to the invasions, which were motivated by security issues, the external powers did begin to build economic relationships, and many generals, some Uganda generals in particular, became very profitable warlords. And so, yes, the economics began to become a factor subsequently. I do not, but I think the reason I'm stressing the point that economics is not what drove the conflict is that I think if the security issues are addressed now in an effective fashion, that the conflict can be transformed. That in the end of the day, Rwanda and Uganda will continue to have economic links to eastern Congo. They don't need to be controlling parts of the Congo directly. There's a natural economic set of interactions that will take place. The issue for them and the issue for the entire region is to get a stable Congo so that you can begin to build a much more regionally integrated economic network. That will be of benefit to everyone. And then one last point I would make is this issue of economic exploitation is still very real. I'm not saying that it's not significant. Even now, you have all sorts of wheelers and dealers and from all around the world that are trying to cut deals with Congolese politicians. And one of the things that we can hope is that Congo now will have build sufficient capacity that they will not get into this historic pattern of private dealings that really, in which most of the proceeds did not go, of the resources, were not being channeled to Congolese development, but were going to the hands of Congolese politicians. There's an opportunity now to begin to really regulate the way in which those economic transactions are conducted. That's much more difficult in the midst of war. That's why creating stability, bringing an end to the conflict, becomes so important.
You're absolutely correct, and I'm wondering to what extent Joseph Kabila is in a position to do that, considering, one, his own connection to that army which, you know, removed Mobutu, who deserved to be removed. I'm not suggesting. You know, we were on the same side with you. And that a person who has, from various reports, at least that we get from Congo directly, written, as including earlier on at the time of the subsequent to the election, that the elections were, you know, highly rigged, and this man was essentially, you know, mandated by the quote-unquote international community to take over, and another Mobutu, in other words, instead of having a fair election that would have led to a sharing of power and be in a position to better control the country. So I'm wondering to what extent such a puppet in many of our, you know, calculations is, you know, sitting there and letting Kunda, who is under UN, you know, a case to be possibly arrested, is seen and nothing is done while we have a UN chief of mission sitting there knowing exactly where he is, but nothing is done against him.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a part of the issue, as you well know, is that the Congolese army lacks all capacity. I mean, it just is still a totally dysfunctional unit. And so there's now an appreciation, slowly growing, that there is no military solution to this conflict with Nkunda. And if Nkunda were not there, the underlying issues remain, and you would still have conflict. And so my hope is that all Congolese will begin to focus upon the necessity for political solutions. And I think they're there. I've been working in the East over the last 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. I've spent much time in Goma, in Bukavu. We've assembled, just in recent weeks, cross-sections of both civilian and military elements of these conflicts, and I see some real possibilities for forward movement. The problem has been that there have been at times mixed messages coming out of Kinshasa, where at the one moment they will be apparently seeking accommodation and reconciliation, and at the next moment we'll discover that arms shipments have flowed to the FDLR. That's not the way to build peace.
No.
And so my hope is that this new conference initiative that was launched just yesterday will bear some fruit, but I think it's going to be a long process. I think it's not going to be it should be viewed not as a single event, but as a launching of a long-term political process. I myself and the leadership training team in which I'm involved, I think will be involved with that effort in some ways. And my hope is we'll be able to build or begin to rebuild some trust, some confidence among these parties and find our way to a political resolution. I'm confident that that is doable if there is a real willingness and some clarity and of direction from Kinshasa. I think this can be accomplished.
If I may ask just a quick question, what do you think of the prospect of bringing Bemba back into the country, Bemba who's in exile?
Yeah, I don't have very recent information. I know that there's been some quiet negotiations taking place about the conditions under which he would return and whether he'd be liable for criminal action or not, but I don't know the status of those negotiations. What I found encouraging, one thing that was very important, I think the most viable institution in the Congo right now is the National Assembly. Vital Kamerhe, who had served as Kabila's campaign manager, has emerged as a remarkably statesman-like figure who has insisted that the National Assembly remain not a tool of one party, but as a vehicle for the expression of all political opinions.
Absolutely.
And so following this terrible shootout between Kabila and Bemba's people that led to several hundred deaths, and Kamerhe was under a lot of pressure to really be vindictive against the Bemba people within the assembly, and he refused. And so there's at least an open dialogue and sense of inclusion and inclusivity within the National Assembly that has helped, I think, to contain some of the potential conflict and has been a source of considerable inspiration, I think, to many Congolese.
Thank you very much for the work you've been doing and you continue to do, and know that we are there in the field trying our best to support that and push.
No, I know. Thanks so much for your call this morning.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, I just want to introduce our guest for the hour, Howard Wolpe. He's director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served 7 terms in the U.S. Congress, and for most of that time, he chaired the Subcommittee on Africa of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and has been very instrumental in crafting U.S. policy toward Africa. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for the benefit of those people who don't follow Congolese politics, the man that you were talking about, Jean-Pierre Bemba, this was the man who in the 2006 presidential elections came in second.
That's correct.
And there was, as you say, there was conflict between his supporters and the supporters of Joseph Kabila, who was the man who in that election came in first, although, as I mentioned, I think before, he didn't win enough votes to get to be elected outright.
That's correct. And there was violence both immediately after what you might call the primary or the first election, and then after the second election when Kabila did win sufficient votes, there was a terrible clash between Bemba's military group that was protecting him inside Kinshasa and Kabila's forces that led to many, many deaths within Kinshasa. It was really brutal, and frankly, United Nations has just found it totally unjustified in terms of what happened at that point.
And Bemba himself is not now in the Congo.
No, he took refuge in Portugal. And I don't know if he's still there or not, but he traveled there. And as I say, there have been continuing, at least private conversations taking place between Bemba and others within the Congo that about the possibility of his return, but I don't know the status of those talks.
Well, just again, to return to the issue of the recent fighting that has been going on in North Kivu, in the northwestern part of the country, and this is in the part of Congo that has common border with Rwanda and Uganda, the place where that has apparently been a power base or at least an important place for this this Tutsi general, Laurent Nkunda. I guess the question still remains, well, what's to be done about him? And is it possible for him to somehow, can he somehow be brought in to the process? Or is this somebody that, you know, can there be a political accommodation or does there have to be essentially military action against him?
My own analysis is that there can be political accommodation and there has to be. Because though he himself has been at times done some terribly ruthless things and a number of civilians have been innocent victims of his military action, there's no question that he sees himself as defending the interests of the Tutsi minority within the East that at many different points in Congolese history has been besieged, has been victimized in many different ways. And so the underlying issue is trying to build a political accommodation between the Tutsi elements within the East and other Congolese populations within that region. And moreover, I mean, just recently, the government has said it was going to have a military assault on Nkunda that would be the end of Nkunda, and the army was totally defeated in that effort. Now, the good news is that that did finally lead the government of Kinshasa to say, well, maybe we ought to try to figure out a way to reconcile. And so this week, beginning yesterday, there's the president launched a dialogue process, which is going to be, I think, extended over some period of time. Laurent Nkunda declared a ceasefire. He announced a ceasefire. The government was initially reluctant to agree to the ceasefire, but finally said it would cease actions against Nkunda for the moment, and Nkunda's party or forces are now are in attendance in this conference that began yesterday, which is an effort to structure a process. It's not going to create an instant solution. It's just the beginning of a process. But I think all of that is hopeful.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that going, again, way back to 1994, after the Rwanda genocide, that part of today's problems has to do with the fact that the Hutus that were involved in the genocide and the killing of the Tutsis in Rwanda fled across the border into the Congo, and not only were there many refugees that may well not have been involved in the killing, but there was Interahamwe, those people who were indeed Hutus who were involved in the genocide against Tutsis. The problem was that the international community allowed them to stay and to become entrenched in Congo, so that now they're established in a sense and tangled up and knitted into the Congo. Is it now too late to do anything about that?
It's not too late, but it's going to require a number of different efforts from a number of different parties. Rwanda, a couple of years ago, made a major effort to encourage a number of the Hutus, Rwandan Hutus, that had taken up residence in the Congo, to return to Rwanda. The government itself and Paul Kagame, its president, have acknowledged that they understand that 80% or more of the Hutus remaining in the Congo were not directly involved or complicit in the genocide. Many of them were children, too young to have been involved. That what they are interested in doing is seeing that the folks that are still leading this group inside the Congo are held accountable before courts of justice, be it the International Tribunal or Rwandan courts of justice. But they're not interested in punishing those who were not involved in the genocide, and they did take steps earlier, a very active campaign, to try to build confidence that these people, who were very young at the time of the genocide, should feel able to return to their communities, would not be harassed, and would be basically protected by law. They have agreed recently to renew that effort, try to, again, advertise the fact. Part of the problem is that you've had these genocidaires, the leadership of these groups, that have, by military force, intimidated and threatened and harassed not only their own population, that this 10 to 15,000 that they control, but also have really wreaked havoc upon the Congolese people themselves. Hmm. The amount of one of the most pathological elements of this violence has been violence against women. The atrocities, the rapes, the physical violence that has been done to women, Congolese women, and according to all accounts, 95% of this has been done by these ex-foreigner Hamwe elements, has been just extraordinary. I mean, it's hard to comprehend, and to hear the when you hear these reports, it's just unbelievable. And so, and the problem has been there's been no military capacity of the army to do anything much about that. And so the challenge right now is to figure out a way where two or three things can happen. One is you encourage the incentives, you advertise to try to draw people out of the Congo back into Rwanda. Secondly, you've got to create effective military capacity, maybe not just involving Congolese, perhaps a coalition of the willing or some other military response that can make credible the determination to end this presence of these genocidaires in the Congo. Thirdly, some of the reports that have been done recently by experts looking at the situation have indicated that there ought to be some very targeted action at some of these leaders, and that their locations are known, their names are known, some rapid interventions could make a difference, and there needs to be also an effort to begin to dry up the funding sources that are coming from overseas and among some elements of the Rwandan Hutu diaspora, so that they can begin to really make clear to the Hutus remaining that their time of looking at Congo as a safe haven has gone by, and that it is in their interest now to begin to find a new way forward. So all those things in combination can make a difference. But that's what is going to require an international community response, not just the Congolese government response. They, at the moment, don't have sufficient capacity.
We have just about 5 minutes left in this part of the show. Again, our guest is Howard Wolpe. He's director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're talking about Congo. I mentioned the fact that over, roughly speaking, I guess over about the last decade, it's been estimated that it could be as many as 4 million people have died as a result of dislocation, disease, starvation, and direct fighting, probably the worst, maybe between 1998 and 2006. But, of course, violence is still continuing. Perhaps you could talk a little bit for the average Congolese person, what this last period has meant and just how crippled the country has been as a result of this very long period of instability.
Well, first of all, the fighting itself, that is the conflict, has actually been restricted to a fairly narrow portion of the Congo. Most of the country has remained generally peaceful and not in conflict. However, the country is so destroyed by Mobutu that, I mean, you have no roads that tie communities together. The only way to traverse the Congo is via air and a series of airports. So you have no health care delivery system of any substance. Educational systems have collapsed. So that the population was already suffering enormously, even without the conflict. Then when you add the conflict on top of this, especially for people in the regions of violence, from Ituri, for a period of time, even in Bakongo, where there were some terrible police actions taken after the election, and certainly throughout in recent times, in northern and southern Kivu, especially northern Kivu recently, this is where the most immediate displacements have occurred of populations. So that the situation for the average Congolese is bad, with or without the war. The war has really created a catastrophic situation for those who have had to leave their communities, have been forced to flee, that have no access to any of the services required to sustain their lives.
Mm. I know that certainly the fighting that has taken place in North Kivu over the last few months has got the attention of the international community, has got some reporting in the media. I was very struck, though, by something that I read, and I think that this was a comment from somebody who was associated with the United Nations, talking about North Kivu, saying that they thought that what had been going on there at the time, and this was perhaps last December or November, was that things were worse there than in Darfur. And one wonders why it is that perhaps that Congo and its politics haven't perhaps gotten a little bit more attention than Darfur. Not that Darfur is not worthy of attention, but do you think that it is something that has generally been neglected?
I think it has been neglected, but I think the dynamics of the conflict in the East are more complicated. It's a little bit easier to comprehend what's happening in Sudan, and even there, there's an oversimplification of the conflict in Darfur and the way it's been treated by the media. I think that in the case of Sudan, the larger dimensions of the religious differences within the country and the Arab versus African populations of the south have added another dimension of interest that has captivated drawn the attention of the West and so on. But I think that I always get nervous about comparing these tragedies to one another. The fact of the matter is that the Congo destruction has been less of the result of direct violence and much more of the indirect causes of health, of starvation, of disease, of the collapse of infrastructure that's been in part because of the conflict, so that it's not had quite as dramatic an element as some of what we've seen in Darfur. Mm.
Well, certainly, no one would want to get into making the comparisons and saying that somehow one was worse than the other or one was more deserving of the international community's attention than the
right.
other. I guess I'm just thinking about how difficult it seems to be to get people to, and then I suppose I'm painting with a broad brush here, but how difficult it seems to get people to pay attention to Africa.
No, well, that's right. I think that, though I must say, compared to the time when I was in the Congress in the 80s, the only issue that would galvanize American attention about Africa was the struggle against apartheid, and there we had a wonderful domestic involvement because the issue of apartheid was seen as much as a civil rights issue as a foreign policy issue. Today, there's a much broader interest in Congress on a bipartisan basis, both in terms of a more positive agenda for Africa, in terms of trade and economic partnerships, and also in terms of the engagement over humanitarian issues such as HIV/AIDS. And so I think that though there's always, you always wish that you could get more attention on these issues of conflict and that have such tremendous humanitarian consequences, I think that we're light years ahead in terms of an awareness and interest in the continent than we were just 10 years ago in the United States.
We have a caller here very quickly. I want to try to get them in, even though we just have about a minute. So
okay.
Here, Crystal Lake, line 4. I'll have to ask you to be fairly quick, but please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering when we're going to have a chance, the American government's going to ever do anything with Africa in general. That country has been in such a dire state of attack and just disarray. Is it because we don't have any oil there, or is, you know, the genocide's been going on for decades? We got to do something over there. Is there any way to get our government to help these people, or what? Do you know?
Yeah, my own, you know, I happen to be one who has been terribly, terribly critical of the current administration in its approach to most of the world. On the issue of Africa, however, there's actually more engagement than I think is generally recognized, because all that you see on your television screens are the war or the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And Africa is a big continent, the 53 countries, and it's very difficult to generalize across the continent. And there are many parts of Africa that are doing much better than the disaster situations that we tend to focus on in our media conversations. And the United States has been very engaged over the Clinton years and even in the Bush years, both in humanitarian interventions, but also in beginning to build through the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, for example, stronger trading relationships with African countries. Foreign investment is flowing into African countries. Obviously, the oil resources of some countries make Africa particularly attractive in those areas, to American investors. But there's much more engagement than I think the general public is aware of, because all the preoccupation is on the most immediate crisis and the most immediate disaster, and that's unfortunate.
Well, I think at that point that we'll have to finish for this first hour of the show. Again, our guest, Howard Wolpe, he's director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served 7 terms in the U.S. Congress, and for much of that time, he chaired the Subcommittee on Africa of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, was very much involved in crafting U.S. policy toward Africa. He's also a former presidential special envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region and was in the Congo for several weeks just this past November, December. Dr. Wolpe, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.